I guess other than anything else is that if you don't hold a job, you're out. I mean, if you don't have a regular job, they can recognize,
right?
You know, you're sort of beyond the pall or something. You know, I mean, like you don't go to a factory or office or whatever. Here in Europe, they have more understanding that artists can't have regular jobs because it's kind of a way of life being an artist.
We're talking about Western Europe, though, not all of Europe.
It's some more understanding that you need more leisure and stuff like that for writing and doing art, you know. But here we're still kind of, in fact, we're more that way now. In the 60s, there was some...
We were opening up in the 60s, yeah, and it's all been pushed back. The right-wing reactionary attitude.
Or Crum, one of my favorite artists and also a real social observer, says that there really was a systematic attempt on the part of the government in this country to destroy the 60s counterculture. It really was a, you know, I mean, because there is this attitude that, well, it didn't have enough to it, so that's why it fizzled
out. That's why they sit down in marijuana, because it's a powerful symbol for counterculture. It's not the poison that heroin and speed can be, but they equate it with that. It's just a big threat. Yeah, you know, and they've done a good job of wiping out what was done in the 60s, which is creating better services for the poor and better opportunities for people of color and all this stuff. And one way I think you ruin it is you dumb down the education system, the public education system, which has been done, so that people aren't as intelligent because they're not well educated, so they don't know what's right to fight for. They're brainwashed.
Yeah, most of my experience in school wasn't really very good. And I was supposed to be this privileged middle class kid in North Berkeley when I'm going to nursery school, elementary school, junior high, and 1 year of Berkeley High. Berkeley High in some ways was really a notch up, but a lot of that stuff was just busy work, you know. But at the same time, you got all this liberal lip service, you know.
Well, where I went to school in North Mass, people Long Island, I thought I was of the last generation to get a good, decent education. Not that it was very liberal, but it taught me how to read and write and do math so I could continue to learn on my own. So in the 60s, when I got involved in it, at the age of 20 to 23, the free speech movement, I was able to pick things up and continue on my own. You know, I was at least able to read and write, and I would assume you got at least that out of your education.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Whereas since we've been to school, well, the schools have gotten so lousy that people can graduate from high school with basically a fourth or fifth grade level of reading. So they don't have the skills to think for themselves.
Yeah. Oh, that's okay, thanks.
Thank you, Lefty. Sure.
I don't like to dwell too much on how things have degenerated. I know it's pretty bad in a lot of ways.
Well, I see a lot of hope in our society now. In my personal life, things have changed. I see a lot of things going on. I think we are going to have another awakening that'll be more empowering and more promising than what we had in the 60s. It's like the next cycle, the next liberal cycle.
Do you think computers can help? Because I remember back in 1980, there were some people around Telegraph who, they even called themselves something like Berkeley Microworks. They felt that computers could be used to democratize a lot of things. Like communication and knowledge and, you know.
I totally believe that, yes. And then I'm using it too. I'm using it as a tool of empowerment to give homeless people and gay people who don't have access to the web a voice on the web, which is the same thing as giving a voice globally. And I, being a poor person, this is great because I can do it for free. So I put people's voices out there. So yeah, I think it can be a very empowering tool for the average person and for civil dissent.
There's this writer, Scott McCloud, who wrote two books about his views on comics, understanding comics and reinventing comics, and he feels that comics are valuable because he says they're one of the few media where really you can hear individual voices, you know. A lot of it's kind of corporate control and stuff kind of shut off, you know, and a lot of the official media. It is a strange situation because mostly comics are looked down on to this day, and
Did you know an author called Fulbert Sturgeon who did comic books called Two Tales of Jesus?
Yeah, I wish I had those. You know, I think I'd enjoy them a lot.
He was an art teacher at University of Missouri, and I modeled for him.
Terrific. Oh,
yes, and it was a big secret that the campus, the University of Missouri, didn't want the public to know that he was the cartoonist for Two Tales of Jesus. I found this out through a friend of mine after I had done some modeling for his class. One of his students I became friends with, Susie Bryant, she showed me the comic. She said, he's the artist of that. And Two Tales of Jesus was this little hippie guy, Jesus coming back, hanging out in Columbia, Missouri, going into being in these awkward positions. Well, you're familiar with the book.
Right, well, but
very funny.
That was one of the very earliest things on comic books, and I'm really sorry that I didn't collect them.
Yeah, because I can't find them. I want to find them again.
Maybe there's some hope. Maybe there's some kind of artwork or good enough copies of artwork to print from, because some things have come back. There's a pretty early comic book, Vicky Brown, The Virgin Mary, got reprinted in much nicer paper, much better printing than the original comic book. I think there might be hope, because I don't know. See, at that time, they were so new to me. I don't know. There used to be bookstore right down there. You see, there's an example of a kind of liberal leftist outlet you don't have anymore. You know, what was it called? Pusadar. It was just down there. Then they moved over to North Berkeley, moved to Solano, became Pegasus.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's mostly upper middle class people who go there. But back then, they had this real informal store, and they were selling they had these racks, these underground comics, and they had the Adventures of Jesus, like you said. Amazing. I think I'd get a hell of a lot more out of that now than back then. It's too much for me to really grasp it.
Yeah.
But you did so many things that, you know how the underground comics, when you first see them, they seem sort of strangely outrageous. This big black guy, Dr. Feelgood, and he did a dog who was always goofing up. I forget the name, Ping or something, but this is a sort of a skinny poodle type dog, and he's always messing around, and like he never learns he's supposed to, you know, not to defecate indoors, and all kinds of stuff, you know. And Frank Stack is going on. He's become one of the major illustrators for Harvey Picar.
Oh,
and American Splendor. If you haven't seen it now, I heartily recommend you go to Comic Relief. I saw 4 copies today of Our Cancer Year, a real novel in comics form.
Huh.
There are a lot of graphic novels that aren't like novels. They're just sort of collections.
Right.
This really is, you know, it's got the chapters, it's got the length, it's ambitious enough. Basically, it's a year when this guy got cancer, Harvey Picar, and his wife, Joyce Briner, had to take care of him. And it's kind of a lesson that if you're in a lot of trouble or you can't take care of it yourself, it's great to have somebody who will stand by you. That's the main thing I got out of it. Frank Stack does all these marvelous illustrations, a lot of work, a lot of wonderful work. And he doesn't draw like any other cartoonist.
Uh-huh.
I don't know what to say. It's amazing. Powerful. Just amazing. And they give a kind of special ovation to him after the story ends. You know, take a bow, Frank, take a bow. Yeah, by now it's come out his name is Frank Stack, but I know what you mean. He even said in a strip he put in Weirdo that, I was Fulbert Sturgeon, but, I don't know, I guess, you know, some of these things you have to be more careful, a lot more careful about or something, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, because academic institutions have been damned hostile to comics and cartooning, you know. A guy who became one of the genius cartoonists, Dan Close, said he went to Pratt Institute to begin with, which had a terrific reputation, but he said a lot of it was crap, and he just never mentioned cartooning in art school. All of it was mindless. And he shows this teacher saying to a young student who worked on a concert, "Sigh, I really expected something from you." And there's a little sign pointing to him that does spot illustrations for plumbing textbooks. That's what he does as an artist.
Well, I was brought into the counterculture movement here in 1970-71 when I was going to University of Missouri. I had some very good friends there, and there was this beautiful young man. Well, we were all young back then. Robert Matthew Childers, I'll never forget. He was like my guardian angel who said, this is the way to heaven, this is the path, this is the counterculture. You want to smoke some grass. And he played Cat Stevens songs to me on his guitar, took me out to the woods, would collect herbs. He lived outdoors.